Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's October 2002 in the living room of the Beverly Hills home of Stan Lee. Just weeks before his 80th birthday, Stan paces the room with the energy of a much younger man. Stan is frustrated, angry, and waiting on his lawyer to arrive. The comic book legend who co-created some of the world's most iconic superheroes, including Spider-Man, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, and the Avengers, is wrestling with a difficult decision. Should he sue Marvel, the company he helped build over the course of 60 years? Stan's current contract with Marvel ensures that he'll receive 10% of profits from movies and TV shows that feature Marvel characters. The X-Men and Spider-Man movies are raking in millions of dollars at the box office, but Stan hasn't seen a dime. Stan's friend and attorney, Arthur Lieberman, walks in the door. Arthur believes a lawsuit is the only course of action.
Well, Stan, have you seen the latest box office numbers?
I try not to look at them. It's too upsetting.
You need to look. Spider-Man could make $1 billion worldwide, and X-Men is still making money. And it's just the beginning. Daredevil and the X-Men sequel will come next. It'll just keep going from there. Stan, the train is pulling out of the station. You need to act now.
It doesn't make any sense. I've always had a great relationship with Marvel, even after my involvement slowed down.
Stan went to work with Timely Comics, the company that would one day become Marvel, in 1940. Since then, he's always worked with the company in some capacity. And over the years, Stan has become the face of Marvel, and he's always felt like they respected his legacy. Until now.
Arthur, I'm hurt. I've made a lot of people a lot of money over the years. I pushed Marvel to get into movies and TV in the first place. Now I feel like they're taking advantage of me.
Then do something about it, Stan.
You think I should sue?
Everyone thinks you should sue. CBS made it clear that Marvel's the villain here.
A few days ago, Stan appeared on a news segment for CBS. The show covered the state of comics and made it clear to viewers that Stan Lee wasn't making any money off the hit movies featuring his famous superheroes. Comic book fans voiced their support of Stan, and many started to view Marvel as an evil corporation that was exploiting the man who made their success possible.
But forget CBS and all that stuff. Tell me this. Why do you want a percentage of the movies in the first place, Stan?
Because I deserve some ownership of my creations.
Well, damn right. You built the company, Stan. Without you, there is no Marvel.
Stan knows his lawyer is right. He's very angry, and he's ready to act.
Okay, Arthur. Let's do it. Let's sue him. But I don't want publicity for it. I'm not doing this to showboat or whatever. I just want what Marvel owes me.
Lawyer Arthur Lieberman moved quickly, and in late October of 2002, Stan Lee sued Marvel. Industry insiders were stunned. One journalist went so far as to say that Stan Lee suing Marvel was like Colonel Sanders suing Kentucky Fried Chicken. Stan's legal battle with Marvel would last 3 years. It would inspire Marvel to change the way they made movies, launch the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and reshape the entire film and television industry. At the time, Stan Lee's anger toward Marvel stemmed from the fact that he devoted the bulk of his life to laying the groundwork for the company's massive success. Stan started building that foundation when he was a young man who believed comic books could tell complex stories and that art and creativity could fuel financial gain. Long before he would face off with Marvel, Stan's ideas would redefine the American superhero, rescue a failing company, and help him rise from humble beginnings to become a business pioneer and a pop culture icon.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Like many of the heroes he would go on to create, Stan Lee had two identities. He was born Stanley Martin Lieber on December 28, 1922. Stanley Lieber spent his formative years in New York, in the Bronx, during the height of the Great Depression. In his youth, he saw his father constantly struggle to find work, and he watched as his parents scrounged to cover rent for their small apartment each month. The fear of unemployment hit Stanley young, and it would stay with him forever. While still in school, he took a job at a trouser manufacturing company and worked as an usher at a movie theater. Stanley quickly developed a strong work ethic and was content to put in long hours when needed. Working at the movie theater also made Stanley fall in love with what the industry people used to call pictures. Stanley devoured the adventure films of Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks, and he dreamed of becoming an actor or writing adventure stories of his own. After graduating high school at 16, Stanley went to work for the WPA Federal Theater Project, one of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal programs designed to fund the arts. Being surrounded by theater people further sparked Stanley's desire to write and perform. Then, when Stanley was 18, his work ethic and his love of adventure stories led him to an opportunity that would change his life. Martin Goodman, the husband of Stanley's cousin, owned a publishing company that had a job opening in its comic book division, Timely Comics. The family connection got Stanley in the door, and Timely's editor gave the hard-working young man a job. Stanley's tasks included things like grabbing sandwiches, filling inkwells, handing out mail. It wasn't glamorous, but Stanley didn't care. It may have been menial work, but he was running errands for Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, the two men who created Captain America. Soon, Stanley would convince Joe Simon that he could do more than just fetch lunch. Joe would give Stanley a chance to prove himself as a writer, and like the superhero Stanley would create, he would develop a new identity that would one day be instantly recognizable. Stanley Martin Lieber would soon become Stan Lee. This is the first episode in our four-part series on Marvel and Stan Lee, Origin Story. It's January 1941 at the Timely Comics offices on 42nd Street in New York City. It's over 61 years before Stan's fallout with Marvel. Stanley Martin Lieber fights off the butterflies in his stomach as he makes his way down the hall towards the office of Timely's editor, Joe Simon. The 18-year-old Stanley is about to make a bold move. He's going to try to convince Joe to let him write for the company. To calm his nerves, Stanley plays a few notes on a small flute he brings with him to work every day. Stanley thinks the music livens up the mood of the place. But not everyone agrees. Stanley puts the instrument down and knocks on Joe's office door.
Come in.
Stanley opens the door and cigar smoke billows out. Joe Simon reclines in his chair behind his desk, puffing away.
Hey, Joe.
Stanley.
You have got to stop playing that damn flute. You're driving Kirby crazy. Keep it up and you'll be looking for work at DC Comics.
Stanley laughs. This isn't a real threat. DC Comics is the biggest name in the business. They have defined the comic book superhero with their creation Superman and Batman. DC is Timely's biggest rival, and everyone in the office views DC as an evil empire. But writer Joe Simon, along with artist Jack Kirby, have finally found a way to challenge DC. Together, they created Captain America. Cap, as the character is commonly known, made his public debut in December of 1940 with a cover that featured the hero punching Adolf Hitler. Readers loved it. Now, Captain America is the only Timely Comics character that might rise to the level of DC Comics Superman and Batman. Stanley knows this, and he wants to be part of Captain America's future.
Well, Joe, I don't want to work at DC Comics. I want to write Captain America comics. Joe Simon is stunned by the audacity of the kid standing in front of him. He can't help but laugh. Oh, what are you talking about, Stanley? I'm happy to get you and Jack lunch or do whatever else you need me to do, but I can do a lot more. I can be a writer. Have you ever written anything? Yeah, I've written short stories, short pieces. I've got ideas for a couple of novels. Stanley, having ideas for a couple of novels doesn't make you a writer. You have no experience. Well, you were young when you started, right? I'm 27. I don't think I'm an old man just yet. You know what I mean, Joe. You got a chance right out of high school, and that's all I'm asking for. Joe pulls on his cigar and lets the smoke fill the room. Joe likes Stanley, and he knows that getting a break when he was a teenager did help him develop into the writer he is now. Well, if I let you do something, it's no guarantee that you'll get any work after that, okay? It's like an audition, you understand? Oh, yes, yeah. I promise I'll work hard on it. Well, I don't doubt that. Let's see. You can take a crack at, the two-page prose piece for Captain America number 3. Oh, come on, Joe. No one reads those. Might as well be advertisements. Prose stories exist in comic books for only one reason. They save publishing companies money on postage. U.S. Postal Service rules allow magazines to be sent out as second-class mail, which costs publishers significantly less than sending their subscription copies via first-class mail. But there's a catch. In order for a publication to qualify as a magazine, it has to include 2 pages of prose, and dialogue inside comic book-style word balloons doesn't count. So in order to pass off their comic books as magazines and get the reduced postal rate, comic book creators include prose stories in each comic book issue. And Stanley is right. Nobody reads them. Well then, give me something people will actually read, Stanley. Take it as a challenge. Hell, attack that prose like you're writing the great American novel. Show me what you can do. Stanley looks Joe Simon in the eye with a determined glare. All right. You're going to love what I come up with, Joe. And after you read it, you'll want me to do more. You just wait and see. Stanley took Joe Simon's challenge and threw himself into the new assignment. The result was a 2-page story called Captain America Foils the Traitor's Revenge. But when it came time to sign his name to the piece, young Stanley Martin Lieber hesitated. Then he signed with the pen name Stan Lee. Stan would later say that he wanted to reserve his real name for the novel he would one day write. He would never write that novel, in no small part because his new identity, Stan Lee, would become his life's work and make him famous all over the world. But in that moment, though, the young, teenage Stan was just thrilled to have his first published story and to have a shot at a career in comic books. Stan's story made it into Captain America number 3, and it featured a drawing by artist Jack Kirby. It was the first time the name Stan Lee and Jack Kirby appeared together in a publication, but certainly not the last. Despite providing the artwork, Jack didn't give Stan's story much thought. But Joe Simon was impressed with Stan's effort. He thought it was witty and fun, and that it grabbed the reader's attention. Joe wanted to give the kid something bigger, so he assigned Stan his first true comic book story. And Stan ran with it. Stan Lee's Headline Hunter, Foreign Correspondent, was a 5-page comic story that appeared in Captain America number 5. While Headline Hunter might not have indicated to the world that Stan Lee would be a future comic book legend, it was clear to Joe Simon that Stan was a true talent, still finding his voice. Joe thought the young writer's dialogue popped, and that he captured teenage vernacular in a way older writers couldn't. So Joe continued to give Stan assignments. And soon the young man was a full-blown comics writer at Timely. At the same time, Timely was a company on the rise. The popularity of Captain America continued to grow, and it was clear readers wanted more superheroes. With the increased demand for comics, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby struggled to keep up with the output their publisher Martin Goodman wanted. They hired freelance writers to pick up the slack, and then they handed some of their lesser titles to Stan. Stan used each assignment to improve his writing, and he took every opportunity to learn from Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. But Stan's desire to study at the feet of Joe and Jack would lead to an event that feels straight out of a comic book. It involved a secret lair and an act of betrayal. It would throw Timely Comics into chaos. It would land a teenage Stan Lee in the editor's chair.
Stan knew that Joe and Jack had converted a hotel room near Timely's headquarters into a studio. They often went there to brainstorm and put together pitches for future work. Stan figured that's where the real action was. So one day, like an intrepid reporter hunting down a story, Stan followed Joe and Jack to their off-site lair. They let Stan inside, but when Stan saw the pages laid out in the room, he knew what the two men were actually working on. They were creating a comic for Timely's rival, DC. When Timely's publisher Martin Goodman caught wind of this, he fired Joe Simon and Jack Kirby on the spot, leaving his company without its two leaders. The way Martin Goodman learned that Joe and Jack were secretly working on something for DC remains a topic for debate and differed greatly depending on who's recounting them. Stan Lee said that Joe and Jack swore him to secrecy and that he never betrayed the men he looked up to as mentors. Joe Simon, who had a soft spot for Stan, said that it was probably common knowledge that he and Jack Kirby were working on a backroom deal with DC. But Jack felt differently. He believed Stan ratted them out to Timely's publisher, who just happened to be the husband of Stan's cousin. But regardless of how it occurred, Goodman learned that his two top creators were working on something for his biggest rival, and Goodman showed Joe Simon and Jack Kirby the door. Just like that, the men who'd created Captain America and put Timely Comics on the map were gone, leaving Goodman needing someone to take their place. Feeling betrayed, Goodman turned to Stan Lee. Goodman felt a familial tie with Stan. He also figured the young man would fall in line and follow orders more easily than established comic book stars like Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. So in the fall of 1941, even before he'd turned 19, Stan ascended to the role of editor-in-chief at Timely Comics. It was trial by fire. Along with being editor, Stan functioned as head writer and art director. It was overwhelming, but Stan threw himself into the job. He got faster and more efficient at producing comics. He also started to understand the business side of comic books, or at least how Martin Goodman liked to do business. Goodman prized quantity over quality, and he made that clear to his young editor. But Stan didn't like the Goodman ethos. Stan knew it was important to turn out a number of titles, but he was convinced that the way to build a large, loyal audience was by giving people quality material and characters they identified with. Unfortunately, the overwhelming responsibilities of his new job kept Stan from taking risks or innovating. He kept Timely afloat and found new talent to bring on board, but there wasn't much room for him to push the envelope when it came to content. Then, in 1942, just as Stan was getting the hang of his new job, world events sent Stan's life and the country into upheaval. The United States had entered World War II in December of 1941, following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But in 1942, the U.S. escalated the war effort, and they increased their call for Americans to get involved. Stan wasn't content to sit idly by and watch as other young men went off to fight. In November of 1942, Stan put an interim editor in place at Timely and joined the Army. Not long after he enlisted, the Army discovered Stan had worked as a writer and an artist, so they assigned him to the film division in New York City, where he was given a job known as Army Playwright and tasked with creating training materials for American soldiers. There, Stan was in good company. He worked alongside the likes of legendary filmmaker Frank Capra, Adams Family creator Charles Adams, and the writer Theodore Geisel, who was already known across the country as Dr. Seuss. While Stan might not have predicted it at the time, writing for the Army would prove to be a crucial step in his career. Stan saw how dry and convoluted Army training materials were. He argued it would be more effective to use humor and present the information in an exciting way. Stan wanted to engage the audience directly and make the materials feel more personal to them, and the Army let him do it. Stan ended up converting large chunks of training manuals into comic book form. Comic books were an effective tool, and the experience showed Stan that comics enabled him to boil down complex ideas into clear, concise stories. And Stan also found ways to use catchphrases and songs in his material, two techniques that would become instrumental later in his career. The work Stan did in the Army would stick with him for the rest of his life, and he would always be proud of it. In fact, later, Stan was known to publicly launch into a little song he'd written once for the Army Finance Department.
Far away from any battle's plunder, we pay off the fellows who fight. Clerks alert, guarding our books from blunder. Payroll forms clutter the floor. We write, compute, Sit tight to boot. Nothing will stop the Army Finance Corps.
When World War II ended in September of 1945, Stan was discharged. While writing for the Army, he'd seen the positive effect humor could have on his readers, and he'd come to understand how simple comics could convey complex ideas. Stan was eager to get back to Timely and put his new skills to work. In late 1945, Stan resumed his old position as editor-in-chief at Timely's new offices in the Empire State Building. Timely's location wasn't the only thing that had changed, though. The comics industry Stan returned to was far different from the one he'd left before joining the Army. During the war, superheroes had fallen out of fashion. Now readers seemed to crave crime stories, and companies were turning them out at a blistering pace. By 1948, the popularity of the crime genre led to a 20% annual increase in the number of comic book titles produced in America. For the time, crime was good business. But this new breed of stories attracted a great deal of negative attention, and a wave of censorship groups attacked comics for being a bad influence on children. Some even called for comic books to be banned, and their cause was gaining steam. As outside pressure mounted, Stan would once again have to put aside his desire to take creative risks and instead commit his time to a fight against the censorship that threatened to destroy the comic book industry and end his career.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's spring of 1948 in Stan Lee's offices at Timely Comics. 54 years before Stan Lee sues Marvel. Stan stares at the phone at his desk and waits for it to ring. He rubs his eyes. He's exhausted. But he's looking forward to the upcoming call. Since World War II, the popularity of comic book superheroes has taken a nosedive, but Stan has helped the company thrive by producing westerns, crime stories, and teen comedies. But now, several of Timely's crime books have been banned, as outside forces push to censor comics across the board. Stan wants to fight back, and he wants his feelings made public. He's ready to talk to reporters, and he knows one of them is ready to talk to him.
Hello, this is Stanley Lieber.
Stan still uses his real name from time to time when giving interviews.
Mr. Lieber, Judith Crist with the New York Herald Tribune. Thank you for talking to me. Now, your company has already seen several of its books banned, is that correct?
Yeah, several crime books, and it's ridiculous.
So you don't agree with Dr. Frederick Wortham, who argues that these type of comics are immoral and inspire violence in children?
Dr. Frederick Wortham is a well-known psychiatrist. He recently hosted a symposium called The Psychopathology of Comic Books, where speakers accuse comics of leading children to violence. Now, people across America have rallied to Wortham's cause and are calling for wide-ranging censorship of comic books. Stan doesn't buy the theory, as he explains to the reporter.
No, I don't agree. We're not selling books on the basis of bosoms and blood. We're businessmen who can't be expected to protect maladjusted children who might be affected by cops and robber stories. And we use stringent self-censorship. We're not producing immoral work for kids, despite what the good doctor might say.
But it's not just Dr. Wortham, though. Police and teachers all across the country are claiming comics inspire children to commit violence. Religious leaders and parent groups are organizing comic book burnings in town squares.
I tend not to side with anyone who burns books. These are the same people who got angry about vampires and comics in the 30s. And if they'd been alive in the 1890s, they would have tried to ban Dracula. Comics are a natural evolution of literature, and some people have always been out to attack literature.
Would you really equate comic books with classic literature?
Comics are an art form. And like all art forms, the results vary, but I do think they have a place alongside other books. And comics are also a business. We have people attacking our livelihood who have no idea what they're talking about. They say we're writing evil stories, but in comics, good triumphs over evil.
Yes, but critics argue that a character like Superman, who is supposed to represent good, teaches children that it's better to take the law into their own hands than to follow the rules.
Well, you know, as much as I might want to, I don't produce Superman, so I'm not going to comment.
Well, couldn't the same be said for a character like Captain America?
Captain America fought Hitler. I don't know anything more moral or patriotic than that.
Do you think this is a fight your industry can win, Mr. Lieber?
Well, yes, because we're right. There will always be ignorant people trying to ban art. It's our duty to fight against that. And I'll keep fighting as long as I have to. Stan's interviews were just the start of his attack on censorship in the late 1940s. He penned editorials and called out critics publicly. Other comic book writers, artists, and publishers joined in the fight, and for a time, their crusade seemed to work. Dr. Wortham faded from the public spotlight, and the fervor over comics died down, allowing the comics industry to continue to flourish. But Stan wasn't happy at Timely Comics. He felt trapped. He wanted to do more with his writing, and he would start looking beyond comics for a new creative outlet. In 1951, Martin Goodman changed the name of Timely to Atlas Comics, and for a few years, Atlas seemed poised for massive growth. On a career level, Stan was thriving. He was making more money than he'd ever made, and he had a dedicated group of writers, artists, and assistants working for him. From the outside, it looked like Stan had everything he could have hoped for. But creatively, Stan felt like he was still banging his head against a wall. When he'd taken over as Timely's editor at the age of 18, Stan had been so overwhelmed that he barely had time to think about the quality of the work the company produced. But now, Stan had a firm grasp on his job, and he thought Atlas was falling short when it came to the material they created. Still, even as editor, Stan felt powerless to make any substantial changes. Even though he was the man in charge of the comics division, he still answered to Martin Goodman, who still put quantity over quality and had a bad habit of chasing a trend. If Westerns were big, Goodman wanted Westerns like everyone else's. If crime and romance were on top, that's what he wanted Atlas to crank out. Stanley believed that if the company took risks and offered something unique, Atlas would flourish further. But that wasn't the model under Martin Goodman. As Stan's frustrations grew, he began to look for other creative outlets. But as someone who'd witnessed the horrors of mass unemployment during the Great Depression, he would never give up a well-paying job with nothing guaranteed waiting on the other side. So instead, Stan continued to put in long hours at Atlas by carving out time to write articles for magazines and newspapers. These freelance writing jobs gave Stan a chance to flex different muscles as a writer, and he developed a knack for the style of direct audience address that had become popular in columns of the day. Stan enjoyed the work, and it inspired him to find more opportunities outside of comics. But any hope Stan had of further dipping his toes in other creative waters was about to be dashed. Questions surrounding the morality of comic books would resurface and then catch fire. And like a villain from one of Stan's stories, Dr. Frederick Wortham would return stronger than ever. In 1954, the outrage against comic books roared back into the public spotlight. Leading the charge was the industry's old nemesis, Dr. Frederick Wortham. In April of 1954, Wortham published a book called Seduction of the Innocent. In it, he argued that comic books are a significant cause of juvenile delinquency. Wortham's claims picked up steam, and groups that had supported him in the 40s remounted their calls for sweeping censorship of comics. Those in the comic book industry hoped the hysteria would blow over like it had in the past. But this time, Wortham had an ally that would prove too powerful for writers and artists to challenge, the United States Senate. The Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency had formed in 1953, and now, with the publication of Seduction of the Innocent, they had a new target in their sights, comic books. The subcommittee opened hearings on comics in New York City's federal courthouse in late April of 1954. Dr. Frederick Wortham was their star witness, and he stated his case as simply as possible.
It is my opinion, without any reasonable doubt, and without any reservation, that comic books are an important contributing factor in many cases of juvenile delinquency.
After the hearings, members of the Senate subcommittee took to television talk shows to hammer home Wortham's argument.
Well, what about the effect of these comic books on the children?
All of our testimony from psychiatrists and children themselves show that it's very upsetting, that it has a bad moral effect, and that it is directly responsible for a substantial amount of juvenile delinquency and child crime.
The fallout from the hearings and subsequent Senate press tour was almost immediate. Anti-comics groups called for crime and horror titles to be banned. Family and church groups across the country urged parents to stop letting their children buy or read comic books of any kind. For the comic book industry, the bottom completely fell out. In October of 1954, the Comics Code was established. The code required comic book publishers to submit their work to a review board that would determine if anything in the books was too offensive to publish. The era that would come to be known as the Golden Age of comics was ending, and insiders wondered if the industry could survive. In 1953, the year prior to the hearings and launch of the Comics Code, Atlas had sold roughly 15 million comic books per month. In 1955, the year after the Comics Code was put in place, that number plummeted to just a third, a 67% loss in sales. Stan watched as companies were crushed under the weight of the Comics Code and the rising tide of anti-comic sentiment. Stan feared Atlas would be next. In order to cut costs, Martin Goodman moved Atlas out of the Empire State Building into a tiny office on Madison Avenue that made Stan feel like he was working in a closet. Goodman also demanded that Stan fire the bulk of Atlas's staff. Years earlier, Stan had assembled a full team of writers, artists, and assistants. Now Stan would have to run Atlas as a one-man band with only a handful of freelancers to help. Constantly under the gun, Stan struggled to crank out inoffensive material that could get by the Comics Code review board and still turn a profit. He found some luck with westerns and harmless titles like Nellie the Nurse, but it wasn't enough. As things fell apart, Martin Goodman doubled down on chasing trends. When Mad Magazine started to hit, Goodman told Stan to start a humor magazine in the same vein called Snafu. Like most of what Atlas was producing, it didn't catch on. And as the 1950s progressed, Stan saw Atlas Comics as a sinking ship, and he feared he'd go down with it. In the late 1950s, Stan had found a way to get past the Comics Code while still turning out work he wasn't completely embarrassed by. While Atlas struggled to survive, Stan had started to produce science fiction comics that had some traction with audiences. But he needed help. Without consulting Goodman, Stan reached out to two artists he'd worked with in the past and welcomed them into the Atlas fold. The first was an artist named Steve Ditko. Steve was as quiet as he was talented. He was happy to have the work and willingly jumped into whatever project Stan threw his way. The other artist Stan hired was the legendary Jack Kirby. Since he left Timely for DC under accusations of betrayal, Jack's career had been rocky, constantly butting heads with DC leadership over money and the creative direction of his work. Ultimately, Kirby walked away from the comic book giant. When Jack got the call from Stan Lee, he badly needed work. And even though Jack still blamed Stan for ratting him and Joe Simon out to Martin Goodman back in the 40s, he was willing to put that behind him if it meant he could start drawing a steady paycheck. With Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby at his side, Stan was able to keep Atlas up and running. But money was still tight, and the future of the company looked bleak. Martin Goodman seemed content to squeeze pennies out of Atlas for as long as he could, with no real plan for the company's long-term security. But the tide was about to turn. No one knew it, but from that small office on Madison Avenue, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and Stan Lee would soon alter the fate of Atlas, revolutionize the American superhero, and give rise to a new company that would forever change the face of the industry, Marvel Comics.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, voices. Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
It's early summer, 1961, in Stan Lee's cramped office at Atlas Comics. It's still 41 years before Stan will sue Marvel. Stan stares at a blank sheet of paper on his desk. He's putting together the upcoming production calendar for Atlas. None of the titles he's set to release give him any hope of turning things around. Still, Stan gets to work. Focusing on the task at hand helps Stan keep the depression from creeping in. Stan feels stuck in a job he no longer wants but can't afford to lose. And it's all at the feet of one man. The office door swings open, and Martin Goodman's shadow blocks out the light from the hall. Goodman speaks to Stan so rarely at this point that Stan figures Goodman's shown up just to fire him. Goodman's main method of dealing with lagging sales seems to be to cut staff, and as head of the comics division, Stanley feels he has a bullseye on his back. Martin, what can I do for you? DC superhero team. Give me something like that. What? The Justice League. Word is, it's flying off the racks. Make me a superhero team, one that'll make us money. While most comic book companies are struggling to survive, DC remains the juggernaut of the industry. In the summer of 1956, they released a comic book titled Showcase No. 4 that featured the return of their golden age hero, The Flash. The Flash slowly rekindled interest in superheroes and helped usher in what would become known as the Silver Age of comics. DC capitalized by reintroducing more of their classic heroes. Now, in the DC Universe, their heroes have teamed up as the Justice League. Martin, we can't just do what DC does. Not with something like this. And why not? They teamed up a bunch of their old superheroes to make a new book. Let's do the same thing. We're not DC. We've never been DC. Our superhero line's dead. This is what I want, Stanley. So this is what we're doing. Stan takes a breath. He's ready to make a stand. And he figures if Atlas is going down, they might as well go down fighting. Martin, let's do something different, something new. And what do you mean by that? We can't be DC, but we can create our own type of superhero. There's nothing real about DC heroes. They have no problems, no flaws, nothing changes from issue to issue. We need something different. Let's make ordinary people extraordinary. Let's make the unreal real. Stanley, the DC model works. Stick with it. No, the model doesn't work for us. Look where we are. Look. We're not in the Empire State Building anymore, Martin. We have to try something new. Let's give people superheroes they can relate to. Let's make the work personal. And not just for kids. Let's create books adults can't wait to get their hands on. We give our characters real problems, real shortcomings, real relationships, and a damn sense of humor. Stan has wanted to take creative risks for years. He believes telling stories that readers can relate to is the way to amass a following. But up until now, Stan has towed the line and done more or less what Martin Goodman wanted. Not anymore. If we keep trying to mimic everyone else, it's only a matter of time before we've got nothing left. I mean, look around. There isn't much left. If we try something new, we might have a shot. Goodman leans in close. Look, Stanley, I don't care what it is, as long as it's a superhero team and it makes me money. Because if it doesn't, I'll know who to blame. Martin Goodman made it clear that if Stan failed, he would lose his job. The idea terrified Stan, but he saw no alternative. Figuring if he didn't try something bold, Atlas would go under and he'd be out of work anyway. So Stan started to brainstorm ideas for a new type of superhero team. And he was confident only one artist could help him bring it to life, Jack Kirby. The two men joined forces and set out to create a new superhero team. What they came up with would revolutionize the world of comics. Together, Stan and Jack would introduce the world to the Fantastic Four, a comic book concept that would mark a complete shift in the superhero genre and be the first major offspring of what would become one of the most important collaborative duos in comic book history. But Stan and Jack's collaboration would also spark questions about who deserved credit, a debate that would plague their partnership for years to come. The events surrounding the collaboration between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in the summer of 1961 remain shrouded in mystery and controversy to this day. Each man will tell multiple versions of what happened, and each would claim that he was the one who came up with the idea for the new superhero team. Neither Stan nor Jack's version of events is guaranteed to be true. But what is definitively true is that in 1961, the Fantastic Four broke the mold of the comic book superhero. Unlike DC's Justice League, that featured well-known heroes of the past who usually fought alone, the Fantastic Four were a family. The characters had real relationships and all the human problems that go with them. Their superpowers were thrust upon them, and they struggled to cope with their new responsibilities. These were ordinary people thrown into extraordinary circumstances, just as Stan had wanted. And where DC superheroes wrapped up each adventure in a little bow and started all over again in the next issue, Stan and Jack decided to serialize their comics. The events of one issue would directly affect what happened in the next. Fantastic Four No. 1 hit the market in August of 1961. Stan and Jack didn't know what the response would be, and they figured there was a good chance Martin Goodman would fire them. But then the fan mail started pouring in. Readers loved the book for all the reasons Stan had hoped. They said that they could identify with the characters. They were afraid for them, rooting for them, because they could see themselves in them. The Fantastic Four series was a hit with the public, but it would become far more than that. The superhero team would go down as one of the most important comic book creations ever produced, leading to more humanized superheroes and introducing the world to the power of Stan Lee's dialogue and storytelling. Stan Lee had given voice to a new type of superhero, and for the comics industry, there was no going back. Not even Martin Goodman could argue. After the Fantastic Four's release, the money flowed in and into Martin Goodman's pockets. Now that they were popular, Goodman wasted no time telling Stan that he wanted more new superheroes. Stan was ready to make them. He had taken a creative stand. He would no longer follow trends. He would set them. And for his part, Martin Goodman would use the success of the Fantastic Four to rebrand yet again. In the early 1960s, Goodman would change the name of his company, and Marvel Comics would officially be born. But Marvel needed a brand new character to become the face of the franchise, like Superman was for DC. And it would be up to Stan Lee to make that happen. As the Fantastic Four continued to ignite readers' imaginations, Stan Lee tried to figure out what new superhero he could introduce to the world. There was one idea brewing in his mind that he couldn't seem to shake. Stan wanted to create a teenage superhero who wasn't a sidekick. Like the Fantastic Four, Stan wanted to start with an ordinary person who comes by his superpowers accidentally. But this hero would also have to deal with things like adolescence, high school, and girls. Stan had a clear picture of who he wanted this kid to be in real life, but he hadn't yet figured out what would make him a superhero. Then, while sitting in his office, Stan watched a fly make his way up the wall. It clicked. Stan wanted his teenage superhero to have the power to walk on walls, but he wanted his hero to be more dramatic and menacing than a fly. As the character crystallized in Stan's mind, he decided it was time to bring him to life on paper. One Marvel artist understood Stan's vision for this character better than anyone else, Steve Ditko. Stan's writing and Steve's artwork would prove to be the perfect combination, and soon, the two would take the comic book industry by storm and bring Marvel Comics to new heights by introducing the world to Spider-Man. Next, on Business Movers, Stan Lee combines his creative powers, his vision for business, and his growing skills as a pitchman to create Spider-Man and expand Marvel's reach, pushing his company to become the next Disney. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. For Wondery, this is episode 1 of Stan Lee, the mind behind Marvel. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Stan Lee, we recommend Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel by Bob Batchelor, True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee by Abraham Reisman, Stan Lee and the Rise and Fall of the American Comic Book by Jordan Raphael and Tom Spurgeon, Amazing, Fantastic, Incredible, A Marvelous Memoir by Peter David and Stan Lee, and With Great Power, The Stan Lee Story, directed by Terry Douglas, Nikki Frakes, and Will Hess. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Michael Federico. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.